We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Caregiver Dave celebrity segment. And I'm first excited to welcome the program, Caregiver Dave. And Dave, I'm excited it's Friday and it's freezing cold. No, 43, but you're in Hawaii and you're just, I'm so jealous. And even Jillian is probably in California right now.
I'm looking out the window and it's just ocean and sunshine and, you know, like it's supposed to be.
See, but Dave's from California, so it's really not fair at all.
Yeah, we're used to that.
Definitely. So,
much of an adjustment.
So let's go ahead and introduce our guest, and it's she has a very interesting background and a movie coming up and stuff. So go ahead and introduce her.
Very interesting. Jillian Clare, American actress, singer. She's best known for a role in Preteen Abigail or Abby Devereaux. Did I pronounce that right? On Days of Our Lives. And for I should know because my wife has been watching Days of Our Lives since I don't know when. My gosh, that program must be 50 or 60 years old. her lead role as Victoria, Tori Archer on Misbehave, a teen drama, web series. And her latest movie, I believe, is Pretty Broken, doing pretty good. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Absolutely,
always
Jillian.
So happy to have you. So how did this all start, Jillian? How did you start acting? You're a singer also.
Yeah.
What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Oh, gosh, that's always the question, right? Well, I was a singer first. I started singing when I was a tyke. I would sit in front of the TV and watch Disney films and started singing the songs, and my mom noticed that I actually had an okay voice. So she put me in singing lessons, and I loved it. And when I was 6 years old, I'm a crazy motivated person. I think it was just born in me. When I was six, I did a 13-song solo show, basically, at different, county fairs in Washington State, where we're from. So I was kind of touring with that little show, and I didn't know that I was acting in it, because to me, I was just playing the part for the songs that I was performing. And a talent scout was there and saw me, and they were like, have you ever considered acting? And, of course, being a child, I had no idea what that was. But my mom, put me in acting class, and then I was like, oh, but I like this, too.
So you had the typical stage mom, did you?
Yeah, I definitely caught the bug. So I started acting, and then my family and I moved down to Los Angeles when I was 8. And I've been doing it ever since.
Now, it's interesting,
wow,
Jillian.
You love it. You're passionate about it. That's great.
She's definitely passionate about it. But
yes, I can't imagine not being in it.
Absolutely. And I was reading up on in your wiki, talked about a commercial as one of the things that started, right, with the child acting, correct?
Yeah. It's one of those crazy stories. The first commercial that I auditioned for, the first national I booked, and it was for Domino's, and it was supposed to be one spot, and they ended up turning it into 13 different spots all around the world and putting different languages to it. And it was literally just me sitting in front of a TV watching something when the doorbell rings because Domino's is at the door.
How old were you?
Oh, gosh, I must have been 8.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a while.
You're making me hungry, Jillian, because it's 4:30 here.
Yeah. Big break. I'm sure it wasn't Domino's, right?
No. The first big thing that I did was Spider-Man, the original with Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and Willem Dafoe. And that was a lot of fun. I played one of the kids in the tram at the end when he's like, choose between Mary Jane and the kids. So I did that we filmed that a week, and then we went back for pickups for another week, and it was wild, just like being on that huge set at such a young age and getting into this tram that they had on like hydraulics so that it actually moved when we were in it. And then it was so cool. Sam Raimi started directing me and telling me to do all these different lines and stuff that wasn't in the script, and it was just so much fun. Kirsten Dunst is still one of my favorite people that I've ever worked with. She took me and a couple of the other girls into her trailer one day and painted our nails.
Wow.
How old were you then?
I was about 9 then.
My gosh. Going under a lucky star.
She's that child actor. She's at least done well for herself, Dave, as we hear about these child actors. Did you think about that when you were young and your mom thinking about that, you know, starting young as an actress, what could happen later on the older you get?
You know, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things when you're an actor, I think especially when you're a kid, you just go out on the audition and have fun doing it. And then if something comes of it, you know, it's great. For me, it's always been the process. I love it. And now as I'm a little older, auditioning gives me a little bit of the nerves, which is hysterical. But when I was younger, I just wanted to do it. I wanted to be in the room and I didn't really think about anything. It was just like, oh, I get to be on this set today. Great. Love it. Let's do it.
So how was your life not normal? Like in school, all your friends knew you were famous, right?
Well, I didn't go to regular school. I had jumped around different elementary schools when I was younger. And then when I entered middle school, I was on days. And I had, you know, the whole six teacher thing. And it just ended up being too much. Like all of my teachers couldn't get all the stuff that I needed. And it was too much for what I was doing on days. So I left regular school and I started to homeschool at that point. And then I graduated when I was 15, got out early, and I started college when I was 16. I only went for a couple of years because I had kept booking things and having to go out of town, and it didn't really work.
Wow. Tell us about Dave's. How did that start? And how long were you on?
I was on for about a year and a half, I believe. And it's a crazy story. I don't know. I have
you won an award, right?
With things. I was 10 when I started that. I just about to turn 11. I was 10 when I booked it, 11 when I started. But I've been doing a lot of theater at a little place called Glendale Funny Theater. I'd done six shows with them. And this woman who worked there at the time was friends with Francine Maisler, who was our casting director on Days of Our Lives. And they were looking for a girl to take over the role of Abby. And she had suggested that I come in and read for it. So she got me the audition. And then they pretty much booked me that day. And it's funny, I know that, especially for soap operas, they like to hire theater actors because we can remember things quickly. And it's usually like a one-shot type of thing, one take, and that's why they like hiring theater people. So I just kind of got right in there, swooped in.
See that?
Awesome. Yeah, I know the Glendale Center Theater. Been there so many times. We lived in Burbank for years and years.
Oh, then you've probably seen me in one of the several different musicals that I was in.
Probably.
Now, Jillian, in that process you're talking about when you were in Days of Our Lives and how it was so hard to go to school. How did you deal with being homeschooled? Then once you decide, hey, I'm going to be homeschooled, what were those challenges? Especially, I mean, you know, the bad connotation of homeschooled and unsocial and all that, which is a bunch of malarkey, in my opinion. How did you stay in touch with people, be involved in things and still, and not have to go to school and do all your schoolwork at home?
Well, I've always been a very proactive person myself. I love learning, so the actual doing of the school was never an issue. When I was on days, we had this incredible set teacher, Bobby, who would do yoga with me for PE. It's actually how I learned yoga.
That's fun.
It was kind of like I had a personal teacher all the time, and she helped me with everything when I was on the show. I love learning. So it was never really, you know, oh, I guess I got to do school. I would, you know, get up in the morning if I wasn't working and do a couple of hours of school, take lunch, do something else, and go back to doing it. And as far as the social aspect, I mean, I was constantly around people, maybe not so many kids, but adults. So I really learned at a very young age how to properly interact with society.
How old are you now?
I am 26, which is very strange to say. I feel like I'm 18.
So. Yeah. 8 years old yesterday, 26.
So you're talking about how old? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't think that the first Spider-Man was out so long ago. You wouldn't think that, Jillian, would you?
I know. Isn't that crazy? It's crazy, and there's been like what, four Spider-Mans, different Spider-Mans since then, and all this other stuff. It's wild.
So being a child actor is dangerous to most of their health. They get caught up in drugs, et cetera. How did you avoid all of that?
I have a really good group of friends. You know, we don't go out much. Of course, I went through the phase of, like, going to the club, but I never really enjoyed it. It was more like, oh, let's go have a couple drinks, and then we'll go home and watch a movie. I've just always been more of a content person, I guess. I like reading. I like knitting. I like my dogs.
So, you're like a normal person.
I'm a grandma. Yeah, I'm a grandma. It's okay.
So how about
watched your trailer of Pretty Broken. Tell us about it.
Pretty Broken is a story of Lindsay Liu, who is going through a rough time in her life. She's 22. She dropped out of college. Her marriage is falling apart. She doesn't talk to her mother. And both of her brothers have their own insanity. And then the one person in her life who's her rock goes missing on an expedition in the Himalayas. So we find Lindsay basically at this crossroads of denial where everyone thinks he's dead, but she refuses to believe it. And she decides that she's somehow going to earn the money and go to the Himalayas to try and find her dad. It's a very heartwarming story. It's totally a slice of life, which is why I fell in love with it. It doesn't need to be big or explosive. There's nothing like huge. It's just humanity at its finest, and I love it.
Wow, and that's really...
How'd you get it?
Now, I was going to go, Dave, real quick, ask a question. When you talk about that kind of role, is that a different role for you, Jillian, than some of the other roles you've played?
Definitely. I mean, it's the first time I've ever top-lined a film, so that was a new challenge unto itself. But I spent so much time. I had actually gotten the script in 2013, so it's been quite the ride with this film. So I spent a lot of time reading things and researching things for this character, and it was a really interesting experience. And our crew and our director and our writer and our producers are all so amazing that it felt like home when we were filming it. And I loved playing Lindsay. I sobbed my eyes out the last scene because it was very hard for me to let go of her.
Mm. Wow. So. I don't know. How much time do we have?
No, I'll tell you what we have time. I'm just interested, okay. Jillian, in this film. Was this an independent? How long did this process take till finally getting this movie out? Explain that whole process. And were you?
Yeah. So, again, with that lucky star thing, I was shooting another film in Oregon, and there had been a writer who came on to doctor that script. And her husband, Brett, he directed Pretty Broken, and he was directing that film, too. So I was working on this film with them, and I was incredibly sick because we were filming in the snow in Medford, Oregon. And I came down from my hotel room one day just looking like a total train wreck. I mean, Uggs, messy bun. It was a look. And Jill, the writer, looked at me and just said, "I have a role for you." And I thought, are you crazy? Look at me. And so she sent me the script, and I fell in love. At that time, it was called Free for All. And we started talking about when we could make it. At the time, I was a little too young to possibly play 22, 23. I've always looked younger than I am. So I was a little too young at that point. And so we had to wait a couple of years to be able to play off the fact that I was 22 or 23. And then once we finally were like, okay, I think it's time to do it, we just started putting the wheels in motion, and it was an independent film. It was very, like, I don't know, it's not guerrilla filmmaking, but, you know, very independent. We were very lucky with our locations and all the people and the incredible cast that we got that were really willing to work for a very low rate. But we were lucky because we were shooting in Portland, so it wasn't hard for us to secure locations and permits. Was a lot easier and a lot cheaper than filming in Los Angeles. And then after that, we played a couple festivals, and then we found Freestyle, who's our distributor, and we're finally releasing it 6 years after reading the script.
Wow.
So what does the future hold for Jillian Clare?
Oh, so much. I have so much to do. But I recently directed a feature film called To the Beach, which is a teen dance movie, and that's on Netflix now. And we're doing a sequel to that, which I'm so excited about. My mom and I are writing it right now. We do the films together, and I'm going to direct that. And I was just asked to direct another film, so I'm looking at that, and they're waiting to get the financing for me to be able to do that. I'll be very excited when I can actually announce what it is. And then I have a couple films in pre-production that I'm going to star in and produce as well. And, you know, it's just the hustle. Keep going.
Exactly.
Directing.
Yeah.
Wow.
See, and what's amazing, Dave, is that the opportunities, as I was talking to people now, finally, with all these platforms, it gives actors the opportunity to be really creative, be behind the screen, and really have the opportunity to get their dreams out there. And Jillian, don't you agree that now,
totally,
with all these opportunities, creative projects, everything's there for you?
100%. I mean, my mom and I, nine years ago, I was at that age when I was a teenager where they were only hiring 18-year-olds to play my role. And she wrote Misbehave, which turned out to be one of the more successful teen web series right when web series were starting. I mean, I remember being in a room with Felicia Day, my mom, Bernie Sue, and a couple of other guys, and talking about how we make web series into the next big thing. And 9 years later, they're massive and exploding. So I think, you know, now more than ever is the time to create. And it's very hard. You know, the industry has changed so much. You have Oscar winners on TV shows. So the people who are playing guest stars are now playing co-stars.
Yeah.
So I think if you have the idea, if you know the friends who can get together and do this, produce your own film, produce a pilot, do something. Just keep working towards the ultimate goal, which is just to be able to only create and only do that all the time.
Hey, that's a great...
Lots of different platforms out there to do that now. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, Dave has a final question for you, Jillian, and you might not have to think about this yet, but Dave is a caregiver, and this is what he is, my co-host, and he's done some amazing things, and he's helping a lot of people. So go ahead and tell Dave the story to Jillian.
Yeah, I was thrust into caregiving because my wife suffered a stroke 22 years ago, and she was only like 52,
wow,
pretty young. And she lost her speech, became paralyzed on the right side. But after a couple of years of grieving, she decided, you know what, I'm still alive. God's not done with me yet. So she reinvented herself, and she decided she's going to do everything she did before, and it was a lot. She's really a type A personality, like Martha Stewart, Wonder Woman. And so I help other caregivers avoid the burnout that usually comes with caregiving. 30% of them actually die before their loved ones do. I mean, it's a rough, rough occupation.
Wow.
So my question to you is, have you ever been involved with caregiving or family members, you know, grandparents? What are the ages of your grandparents or your parents?
Well, actually, all of my grandparents have passed away. I lost my last one in August or September of last year, my grandpa. But one of my grandmas had dementia. So that was very hard on my mom and our entire family. And I watched, you know, she was in one of those private homes that had like six residents, and it's just an actual house and nurses are always there. So I watched my grandma go through that. And then one of my other grandma, she had cancer for several years. So I watched that as well. And, my dad recently, a few years ago, went through something that he was in a coma for a couple of weeks. And when he woke up, he had to relearn how to walk. So that was definitely rough. I mean, I know
that. So you're no stranger.
I'm no stranger. I mean, I haven't been through the long-term haul of it ever.
Yes.
But I know how incredibly difficult it could be for someone to do that. I've had friends who have had, you know, a long-term issue with one of their family members. So I understand, and that's incredible that you're doing that, and wife sounds absolutely amazing. I might start crying. I'm very sorry. I'm an emotional person.
Oh, bless your heart. Well, that's why I set up my website, caregiverdave.com, to just help caregivers stay alive, stay healthy, stay out of the hospital, because it's a tough, tough job.
That's the biggest thing. I remember when my grandma, the one who had dementia, she was my mom's mom, she initially fell in her home, and she was still living alone, and she was, you know, well into her late 80s and still living by herself and driving and doing the whole thing. But she had fell in her home and broke her hip and couldn't get to a phone. And finally, her neighbor noticed that her paper from the day before was still on her porch, went over to check on her, found her, and she got into the hospital then. And we drove from Los Angeles up to Washington State in, like, I don't even know how fast. I'm pretty sure we probably should have gotten like 20 tickets because we were going too fast. But my mom and I were in the hospital, I think, for 4 days straight until I was finally like, okay, you need to go to sleep. Like, we need to sleep for a second. We need to leave for a second. She's going to be fine. That was before the dementia had set in. So she was just,
wow.
You know, couldn't move because of the hip. But I know it's very tough on people, and I commend anybody who's living through that.
So, Jillian, you have to...
On my caregiver radio show, I'm sure you can bless a lot of caregivers with your story.
I will definitely connect you to her publicist. Now, here's the thing, Jillian. You need to create... you and your mom need to create a movie about Dave. That's what you got to do. Mm. There's an idea. Then you're going to get a different... See, I'm already... See, that's what I do, is I just create and come up with ideas. But that would be one really interesting...
You're full of great ideas,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yes. Someday they'll make money. But...
And you're talking to a writer.
Exactly. So, Jillian, that would be great. Create a story about how Dave... and his wife, and how that story has led to helping so many people. And caregiving needs to be out there more, especially what you're dealing with. And we're seeing platforms, Jillian, and these platforms that no one's talking about. But
I was just going to say, what is...
It's like you started to cry. It's really a heart wrencher, the topic.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's an Oscar film right there.
Hey, okay, Jillian, so you already got the idea. Contact Dave. You're both
Neil's
in L.A.
I probably want 10%.
I want more than 10%. Come on. I take 20% in my deals. Come on now. No, but Jillian, best place we can find information on you, learn more about you, where we can watch the film right now. Is it in limited release in theaters, or is it just going, how's the film going out?
Right, so you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, just at Jillian Claire with no I in Claire. My mom always said there's no air in Claire. And for the film, it is coming out March 1st on Amazon, iTunes, everywhere on VOD. And if you're in Los Angeles, it will be playing at the Lumley Theater in North Hollywood for a week. And we're doing a Q&A each night at the primetime showing, which is, I think, the 7:20 showing. So if you want to come by and meet me in person and meet some of the cast members, we'll be there at every 7:20 showing.
Dave, you're still in Hawaii. See, isn't that? See, Dave, all you have to do is.
Yeah, you're in my neighborhood over there.
Yeah, exactly. All right, but.
Oh, you are?
I moved from Burbank to Santa Clarita because I have a gas station up in Castaic Lake
on
Interstate 5 at the bottom of the Grapevine.
Yeah. Oh, I know that Grapevine well.
Yeah, right? Everybody pulls in there because their gas tanks are on empty and their bladders are on full.
Exactly.
I've been there. I've probably been there.
All right. Well, yeah. Jillian, thanks for calling. Best of luck with the film. So I could check that out on Amazon then as an Amazon Prime, correct? You said it's available on Amazon?
Yeah. Not Amazon Prime. It'll be for sale on Amazon and iTunes March 1st.
Okay. All right. I'm going to check you out on Netflix for sure.
Show.
That's because I binge watch all stuff. I'm going to watch you in that film on Netflix. I'll have to reach out and tell you what I thought after I saw it on Netflix. All right. Well, thanks, Jillian, for calling. Appreciate
awesome.
It.
Thanks,
take
Jillian.
Care, guys. See you later.
Thank you so much, guys.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was the Neil Haley Show. Take care, everyone. We're back, the Neil Haley Show, on the Total Education Hour segment. And I tell you what, when we talk education, I've really been excited to talk about the past guidelines. And we continue the conversation. Last month, we talked about a security team. This month, we're going to go into some really interesting things involving school entrances and interior classrooms. So I'm excited to welcome the program, Mark Williams. How are you from PASS? Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Neil. Hi, it's great to be with you again. And really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit more about PASS. And also want to thank you for your efforts in highlighting, you know, the importance of safe schools and common sense approaches to enhancing our K-12 environments. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I love how we're working together to really just keep our kids protected. It's such an important part of it. These horrific incidences that happen and everything. So let's kind of talk about specifically our topic.
Sounds good.
All right, so let's go into it. What's so important about the next step after we get our security team in place? What's next?
Sure. You know, after the security team is in place, we really, you know, just let me back up and put a little context around this. The PASS approach to security is a layered approach. And what layered security means, it combines components within a layer that effectively deter, detect, and delay adversarial behaviors. So as each layer gets bypassed, the next layer provides additional layers of protection. So what we're planning to talk about today, I think, were the building envelope and the classroom envelope. And those are two layers that sit inside of a district-wide layer, a property perimeter, and a parking lot perimeter. The next layer in is the building perimeter. So what the safety team really does then is kind of pulls together and looks at a risk assessment. So building by building, if you've seen, we talk about this all the time. If
yes.
you've seen one building, you've seen one building. They're all different. So doing a risk assessment and looking at, you know, what security measures are already in place and then identifying areas where you may want to enhance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense because, again, when you're looking at the school entrance, you're not talking about the entrance into the building. You're talking the school entrance right when you enter the parking lot, correct?
We talk about actually entering the property. So right when you come onto the school property is the first layer of security. Then the parking lot is the next one, and then the building perimeter, and then the interior perimeter. So it works from the outside in. Absolutely.
Wow. And this is a great thing if we're able to monitor and figure out what's happening when people enter our campus, because we can catch things before an incident even occurs, right?
Exactly. That's the goal. The goal of the components that sit inside of each layer, and there's seven of them, and I'll mention them briefly here. And the first two we talk about all the time as being the most important. The first component are policies and procedures. So we should have policies and procedures for how we look at our property perimeter, how we look at our parking lot perimeter, et cetera, all the way into our classroom perimeter. The next component are people, roles and training. The point that I like to make when I'm talking with groups in front of organizations or at conferences where we're presenting is that the most effective thing schools can do are have effective policies, procedures, and a vigilant staff and students. That doesn't cost a lot of money. These are the first two components that we talk about all the time.
So it doesn't cost a lot of money, and kind of explain what you mean by that.
Well, by having a policy, let's talk about the building perimeter, because that's really where a lot of folks notice that security starts, right? They come to the front door, and in a lot of schools, they may have to hit a button on an intercom that has a camera and tell them who you are and why you're here kind of thing. Policies and procedures at the building perimeter are things like, you know, just categorizing your exterior openings. I mean, that's a very simple thing. You look at your exterior openings on your building and you say, I'm going to have primary openings. These are openings that we want to use and that we want people to come in and out of. They're very limited. Then you have secondary openings, which you may use for sporting events or theatrical events or, you know, plays, things like that. And then you have tertiary openings. So the secondary and tertiary openings, we have a lot of openings around the outside of a building. Most of them are there for one reason, and that's to get people out in the event of an emergency. They're not there for people's convenience so they don't have to take an extra 20 or 30 steps from their car or their bicycle or where they get dropped off to get into the building. They're there for emergency egress. And too often what we find are those openings are not treated with security in mind, if you will. They'll have,
definitely.
They'll be propped open. They'll have active trim, you know, lever trim or some type of trim or a key in them that allow people to get in from the outside. Does that make sense?
So are you spotting that happening still this day and age? And we're talking about public education. I know we also talk about private schools, which need a lot of work sometimes in their security perimeter. But really, are you serious that still these things are going on when you visit schools or hear about it from other people?
Well, Neil, we have a lot of existing school buildings that are out there. We have, you know, well over, I forget what the number is. It's well over 100,000 public school buildings that are out there that are, you know, average age of 45 years. So, you know, security 20 years ago or 30 years ago when I started into it was, you know, trying to keep kids from sneaking into the gym to shoot hoops on the weekends. So, you know, the environment has changed a lot. So a lot of this is going back in and thinking about and retrofitting existing buildings. So it may be removing, if you're going to categorize your openings, it may be, hey, when we look at this secondary opening, we want to remove the key. We don't want to have key access. You know, another policy and procedure would be to move to things like patented or restricted keys that can't be duplicated,
right,
you know, at the 7-Eleven down on the corner. Things like that, just key control policies. Who do we give keys to? Things like that.
So that's true, because you would be very surprised as running as a head of security to know certain people have access to things and then they give it to parents or someone else or students sometimes after school and the perimeter is not as protected.
Right. And that's the advantage when we start talking about getting into electronic access control. And I know you're pretty familiar with that.
Yes, I am.
A lot of the electronic access control products. Yeah, we talked about that last time. But, I mean, the advantage of the electronics is you can control who goes through what door and when. With a key, you know, it's a credential, just like a card is. But with a key, you know, the key works every time you put it in the lock. A card works only when it's programmed to work. So you can control access to your buildings a lot better through an electronic means. But if the school district doesn't have the means to install access control, going to a patented or restricted keyway where the key blank is actually controlled by the school, then and having a good key control policy with keeping track of who has those keys is a cost-effective alternative to that.
And when you have access control and they have the monitoring to see when everyone's accessing the building and you have motion detectors and also video management software, you can really spot who's coming in, coming out, when they're in, when they're out, and reports and everything. It's just so amazing.
Yeah, it is. And it depends on the level of security that you need in your building or that you want in your building. That's the whole tiered approach that PASS takes. Is it works from basic, which is tier one in all these components, to tier four, which is the most sophisticated levels. And, you know, the schools can decide what's appropriate for them. But the two questions that school administrators struggle with is, you know, what should we do and how do we prioritize? And that's a question we get asked all the time. And I think the biggest need we see out there in schools is just helping them understand where are we, what do we have, and then kind of what do we need based on our risk assessment.
So
it's a process for sure.
It's a complete
and
process.
School administrators are being bombarded. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Neil.
No, it's a complete process. And again, as I've found out from some research, that a lot of these school districts have different roles and responsibilities for the security. So there's a lot of things. And you think about specific buildings, you might have a director of security, but you're monitoring seven different buildings. And then certain people are in charge of that building. And there's different rules and regulations and how to control that and funding. All these things are in play.
And you know, Neil, that just that's absolutely true, and that feeds right back into, you know, what I was mentioning earlier, which is, you know, the first layer of security we have in the guidelines is district-wide. And you need to have district-wide policies and procedures, and you need to have district-wide roles and training so that, you know, to your point, when you have people in the various buildings in charge of the safety of those buildings, they're all doing things the same way. They all know what to do when they come to a certain, they get into a certain situation. And that's the importance of the whole roles and training piece. And I think you're going to be talking with Guy Grace at some point in your series here. And Guy has done a wonderful job at Littleton Schools implementing roles and training. I've had the opportunity to sit through some of his what he calls tabletops that help schools understand, okay, who's in charge, who's second in charge, what are our roles and responsibilities, what do we do if, kinds of things. And all these things are also in the guidelines. So it's not just talking about locks and, you know,
exactly,
card readers and things like that. It's the processes and procedures and, you know, making sure your staff and students are vigilant.
And so when you talk about, let's talk about, you said controlling the school entrances. Now let's go into the interior classrooms. Once we're inside the building, there's a different type of layer of security, right?
Absolutely. Inside the building, years ago, we had, before we had sprinkled buildings, we had more doors. And we had what we call cross-corridor doors. Those are the doors that kind of went across a corridor that were generally held open, that allowed, you know, students to and staff and folks to move freely in the building. But in the event of a fire, they would automatically close. They were tied into a fire alarm system. With the advent, you know, if you think about that in terms of, you know, why were those doors there? Those doors were there to contain a danger, meaning a fire, into a specific area of the building, keep it from spreading. With the advent of sprinklers, we have fewer fire doors in our school, so we don't have as many cross-corridor doors. So when we consult with architects, we talk about the fact that it's important to be able to segment a building in terms of security and containing danger into, you know, one area of the building and to keep it from moving around, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. So you're looking at the policies and procedures, not even talking about the monitoring of security if there is an incident, but if there's a fire, if there's a flood, if there's some specific things, there's got to be procedures of where the kids go in case of that emergency or earthquake or God forbid, an active shooter.
Yeah, absolutely. So if there's danger in one area of the building, we want to contain it to that area of the building. And my point is, we used to have fire doors that would serve those needs. Now we don't have to put them as many cross corridor doors into our school buildings. So it makes it more difficult to kind of contain danger into a specific area of the building. So, you know, as part of our architectural component, which is another one of the components within the layers, we talk about being able to segment your building and block off, you know, areas of the building so that if there's danger or something going on in one area of the building, we can keep it there. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And so you're saying architecture needs to go back to the days of the fire doors almost, or ways that there are areas where you can cordon people off in all in one area.
Absolutely. Exactly right. And your point about, you know, do the students know what to do and where to go? That's another important piece of when you're thinking about safety and security. If you think about the fact we haven't had loss of life in a school fire since the mid-50s, we practice. You know, we practice fire drills. People know what to do in the event of a fire. So planning, preparing, and practicing works. And it works the same way with safety and security. So, you know, other weather is another great example. You know, schools go into lockdown all the time these days. And having those kind of policies and practices in place help protect our students and staff from danger that could be outside the building.
Absolutely. Wow. Again, we're talking to Mark Williams here from the past, talking about controlling school entrances and interior classrooms for security. And there's all these layers we talk about. One thing I would kind of recommend also talk about, you talked about that, where to cordon them off and all that. But what about identifying the security cameras, motion inside the building, a little different than we're talking about the outside of the building with access control? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, interior cameras can be tied into access control systems. Typically, they are. You look at—I've been in many schools where they have security rooms where they have lots of monitors up. The video pieces of technology today are vastly different than they were years ago. We have pan, tilt, zoom. We have motion-activated cameras, but it's important to be able to know what's going on inside your building, and it's also important to know when it's happening. There have been instances where law enforcement or responders have come to a building and they're looking at video, and they don't realize that the video they're looking at is on a 20-minute delay, so they're not getting instantaneous information. Yeah. So video's very important in terms of identifying where something might be going on and who might be responsible for it.
That's awesome. Am I missing anything from when you're talking about the interior inside the building that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been a huge movement towards like barricade devices, these devices that schools are implementing to block their doors, their classroom doors. We spend a lot of time. First of all, they violate life safety codes. Second of all, they violate the ADA law. And I would point out that in the Sandy Hook Commission, the commission that went in and studied the Sandy Hook event back in 2013, pointed to the fact that there's not one documented instance of an active shooter breaching a locked door. And that's what, you know, I think that's significant. The Parkland, if you look at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission report, they talked about classroom locks. And one of the things we talk about in the past guidelines with respect to classrooms is there's a lot of ways to lock the door.
Right.
The traditional classroom locks. Traditional classroom locks were designed so the teacher would carry a key. They would come to their door. They would turn the key 360 degrees, which would unlock the outside lever, and they would leave it unlocked during the day. If they wanted to lock that door, they had to go out into the corridor, put their key in the lock, rotate it 360 degrees, close the door to have the outside lever locked. In the guidelines, what we talk about are various options where the teachers don't have to go into the corridors, you know, if there's something going on out there, if they're in a lockdown condition, to lock those doors. And there's a number of different options from a push button, you know, just hitting a push button like you have on the front door of your house probably, that locks that outside knob or lever, to more sophisticated wireless products that fit into access control systems. But locking your classroom doors, being able to lock your classroom doors is the best thing you can do. We're also talking a lot about putting security film on windows that are in classroom doors. It's important to have visual access into rooms or from inside the room outside into the corridors to see, you know, what's going on. There's been some instances like at Parkland where the shooter actually shot through glass the classroom doors. And incidentally, today is the 1-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
And you know, our hearts and thoughts and prayers continue to go out for those families. But we learned a lot there when that shooter actually went up to the third floor. Was in a teacher's lounge and was trying to shoot through the glass down into the courtyard at the students who were fleeing the building. what they found was there was a hurricane film on those, on that glass. And what happened was as the bullets hit that glass, it actually fragmented the bullets and nobody was hurt. So we're seeing more and more movement towards putting a security film on classroom glass doors or side lights that, you know, again, it delays. I've seen videos of security. Yeah, the security film, it takes somebody a minute and a half to shoot through it and then break through it. And in an active shooter incident, they're not going to take time to do that.
They're definitely not.
Get in and...
Exactly. They want to get in and get out. And if it's harder for them to do it, they're just not going to do it, Mark. And one thing, what did the past guidelines think about metal detectors? One of the older things where, you know, you're going through, do you think we should have metal detectors in a lot of the schools?
You know, there's a wide range of opinions on that. What we are seeing is we are seeing schools that put them in, taking them out. There's several reasons for that. First of all, they're expensive. Second of all, they require a lot of maintenance and calibration. Third of all, students figure out ways to get things around them. And, you know, I think last but certainly not least is, you know, if you think about metal detectors, when do you find out someone's coming in with a gun? When they're standing right in front of you.
Definitely. So that's where the surveillance helps. You could spot these things before they happen, and the medical detectors are not always the best thing. And it's hard, and it takes time. It takes a lot of time and effort for sure, Mark. Interesting that we're going away from that.
Yeah. Well, and there's some emerging technologies, Neil, and some of the emerging technologies around video is they're building artificial intelligence into video that actually it's called weapons detection. So it can detect a weapon when that someone's carrying 100 feet away. When you think about metal detectors, you think about airports and, you know, everybody queues up. Think about what happens in a school and the logistics. You've
right,
got
exactly.
500 kids coming to get into their classrooms and you got to move 500 kids through a main entrance and metal detectors in 10 minutes. It doesn't happen. With the advancement in video technology, there are test sites out there that, you know, that I've read about and talked with some integrators about where, you know, huge amounts of people can move through the openings and, you know, you pick out the ones that are the problems as opposed to, you know, the metal detectors, which is one at
exactly.
a time. And have the challenges we just mentioned.
All right. Well, Mark, where's the best place we can find information on the pass and so that all school districts and parents and everyone can access it to find out how to keep their schools safer?
Awesome. Neil, the best place is we've got a website. It's pass, PASSK12.org. You can download our guidelines there. It's free. We also have a checklist, which is awesome, that helps schools kind of assess where they are now and look at areas where they may want to enhance. It's interesting that the and just a couple things here. Ohio School Security Report and Recommendations just was issued this week. It was it was commissioned by the state of Ohio, and they recommended the PASS guidelines in that report.
That's great.
And
that's
they included
really
the checklist in their recommendations. Parkland Commission also referenced PASS. NFPA 3000, which is a segment you may want to think about doing, Neil, NFPA 3000, and I can put you in contact with them.
Yes, definitely.
And the Federal Commission on School Safety also references PASS. So PASSK12.org, free downloads. You can communicate with us there. We'll respond to you. And, you know, we're just really thankful for the opportunity to be with you today, Neil. Thank you.
Well, Mark, loved having you on. Look forward to talking to someone else next month for another segment on the PASS guidelines. So thanks again for calling.
Thanks, Neil.
Take care. See you later. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care, Neil.
We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Caregiver Dave Celebrity Segment. And Dave, this is an exciting day. 50th anniversary of Hee Haw. We have four guests. You never thought you'd do four interviews in one day with me. So we're going to have a really fun Friday. So go ahead and introduce our first star. And I look forward to chatting with her. So go ahead and introduce her, Dave.
I'm so honored. Lulu Roman, for those of you who may not remember who she is, she's an American comedian and singer. She's probably best known as a regular on the comedy music show Hee Haw, 1969, if some of you were even alive back then. Roman was born with a thyroid dysfunction in a home for unwed mothers and placed in an orphanage home. Well, you've certainly made something for yourself, haven't you?
I have. Thank you.
Absolutely, Dave. And so, Dave, your fondest memory of Lulu, he's a huge Hee Haw fan. I am, and Dave asked me, Dave asked me, do you watch the show? Because we did interview Jana a couple of months ago for an event in the summer. And Dave asked me, do you know of Hee Haw? I said, I know of it in passing, but Dave loved the show. So you have a big fan interview.
Thank you.
So go ahead, Dave. What's your fondest memory of Lulu, Dave?
Well, now, I was 15 when I was on, and Lulu, I'm so glad that they, gave you so many parts, because you're very funny, and you are a great comedian. I'm surprised they didn't, I don't remember you singing on the show, but you have an amazing voice. I heard a video.
Thank you very much.
Blast.
All right, thank you.
Did you sing on the show ever?
I did, yeah.
Okay, well.
I did.
Well, but congratulations, you lost like 200 pounds at some point.
Yeah, I did.
Good for
you. Yeah, that was more fun than I don't have to have, honey.
That's like two people.
Yep. It is, and I hope they're not hiding in my basement somewhere.
So what inspired you, Lulu, to lose that weight? What was the big motivator?
I think long life.
Yeah, so... So you look pretty healthy, according to the pictures I see.
Thank you very much.
You don't look like the same person.
Yeah, I've lost a lot of weight, honey. I have.
And you've overcome a lot of difficulties, not only being an orphan, but you suffered with drug addiction during the show.
I sure did, yeah.
You're a Christian.
You've
got inducted in the Gospel Music Hall of Fame in 99.
Yep.
Along with Barbara Mandrell and Loretta Lynn. So, I mean, that's not too shabby.
That's some nice company, isn't it?
Woo-hoo! Yeah. You had a number two hit 7 times.
Uh-huh. I did. Thank you.
All right, Dave, I'm going to go jump to some questions. You're giving her a great bio. So, Lulu, now tell me specifically enough the whole process of how you got on Hee Haw. Tell us that story.
Well, I'm thinking probably maybe 2 or 3 years before Hee Haw ever started. I knew Buck from working in the Dallas nightclubs. And he used to tell me, he said, you're the funniest thing I've ever seen. And one of these days, you're going to be a big star and I'm going to have something to do with it. And I'd bump that cowboy hat and I'd say, keep talking, baby. And by golly, he did.
Wow.
They when they started the show, they had a kind of a list of what they wanted for performers because they weren't real fond of the idea of having a cattle call for that many people. Mm-hmm. So they found Roy in Vegas, and they found Buck in Bakersfield. And they had, you know, a couple of people that were writing for them. They had help with, you know, trying to find the characters that they were looking for. And they just asked all these guys they started with, like Buck, you know, we're looking for one gorgeous blonde and one gorgeous brunette and one girl next door type and one boy next door type and one fat, dumb woman and one fat, dumb man. And Buck said, I got your girl. She's in Dallas. That's how that whole thing started. The next thing I knew, my phone rang, and Buck said, now just sit there and listen to me, okay? Because I generally just had I could just chatter right back. And he said, just listen to me. He said, they've started this thing, and they're going to do this show, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I said, okay. And he said, they need for you to be in Nashville at a certain date. Stuff. And I said, well, all right, I will. So I showed up, and the next thing I knew, they stood me up in front of a camera and had me read a cue card. And I heard one of the fellas back there say, my God, she's incredible. And I turned around and I said, my God, give me your money and watch me get better. Okay. So they took me at my word. And the next thing I knew, I was the round, chubby one on Hee Haw. Right.
As they say, the rest is history. So
yep.
Were you, yes. When you saw what was going on there, were you as optimistic about the show, or were you kind of agreeing with the critics that this?
I was, I kind of agreed with the critics at first because, see, I had never, to begin with, I was not into country music. I was a hippie kid. I ate LSD and ran around in water fountains. So I was the next thing to crazy.
Wow. So did a lot of the cast members think that the show was kind of corny and what the heck am I doing here?
When we first started, everybody just kind of looked at each other and went, Yeah. Nobody was sure except for the guys who thought it up, you know?
Yeah.
And they were real smart and they did real good.
Well, I read that the magic of the show was in the editing. You know, they were just doing fast clicks, you know, it was almost like the Rowan and Martin's laugh in for country, and it worked.
Oh, yeah, it did.
And there's been
so
nothing.
We're on the 50th anniversary,
yeah.
I assume.
Yeah.
Yes, can you believe it? Thank
how
you.
Many, how many did not make that one? I saw that the 10th anniversary, everyone was there. How many were missing the 50th?
We've lost. Honey, I think I'm about the only one left. Of the originals that were, you know, on the first Hee Haw shows. We just lost Roy, and he and I were the last two. And I ain't going nowhere, y'all.
Good for you.
We can tell. We can tell. Now, so Buck was an original, too, or was Buck more? Explain Buck to us. Yes, so Buck is going to be on the show today later, too, as well. So is he going to say good things or about you, Lulu? What do you have nice to say about Buck? He discovered you for sure by giving you this opportunity that changed your life.
He did. Buck is the one that got me on the show. Buck and I were great friends. We were. I understood him well. He was not one to joke around, and you know, he was very business minded. Okay, when it was time for him to be there, he showed up. He was on time. He knew his lines. If they had to, you know, if there were things that he had to do, he knew them. He did. And he was the consummate performer. He sure was. He's a wonderful guy. And Roy was kind of the opposite in that he was the fun-loving guy. Roy loved to have fun. He kind of showed up when he wanted to. Hmm.
Wow. You know, and so about
what was your some of your favorite moments on Hee Haw?
Yeah.
What did you enjoy doing the best over there?
It was also good because it was, you know, we became family after a while, you know, we did. So having the opportunity to get to play with each other and work with each other. Of course, my favorite thing, of course, was the truck stop, because not only did we get to eat food, we got to throw it. And that was the best part. That was fun.
Being one of the original members, Lulu, talk about the connections you have with your fans that today, from today, from before, and just connecting with people that watch the show. How fun is it?
They have just always been the best. You know, I realized that, you know, first of all, on a show that no one ever even thought about doing anything like, okay, to be a part of that, and then to be the effect girl on the show, okay, that was something really extraordinary, and really it was a major blessing in my life. It was. I never realized that it was going to turn out to be what it did. And the people, the fans, have been so incredibly true to it.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.